Christchurch artist, illustrator and designer Leo Bensimon was a member of The Group, a powerhouse of New Zealand art between the 1930s and 70s. He may have rubbed shoulders with many of New Zealand's artistic and literary elite until his death in the 1980s, but Bensimon remained something of an outsider artist. He painted what he wanted to paint rather than what was popular. Leo Bensimon's work is celebrated in an exhibition and book, both the work of Peter Simpson. I asked Peter about the year Leo was living with fellow artists Rita Angus and Lawrence Bagent. Peter, do you remember when Leo first came into your orbit, if you like, when you first took an interest in Leo's work or became aware of it?
Yes, I've been thinking about that, and I think it probably came about through Lawrence Bagent, who was Leo's closest friend, and who happened to be one of my teachers at university when I was a student in the early 60s. And I remember on one occasion, I was a third-year student. This would have been 1962. And Lawrence was my tutor for Shakespeare and tragedy. And much to my surprise, he asked me to stay back after a tutorial and invited me to come and pay him a visit at his house. Such a thing had never happened to me before. But anyway, I agreed to and went round to his house. And there were Leo Bensimon paintings all over the walls, very striking and unusual paintings. And so I think that was probably the moment that I first became aware of Leo Bensimon.
Of course, Bagent and Bensimon and Rita Angus are a tight threesome, really.
Well, they were for one particular period. It really only lasted about a year, and it was in the late 1930s. Rita rented a studio apartment from the painter called Sidney Thompson, who was quite well known, and he spent most of his life in France, but every now and then he would return to New Zealand, and on one trip he bought a house and had it remodeled into three artist studios. And when he was in New Zealand, he used one of them himself, and when he was in France, he rented them out. So Rita rented one in 1936, and then about 15 months later, Thompson returned to France, and another of the studios became vacant. And Lawrence and Leo, who had been flatting together prior to that, moved in. And that was at the beginning of 1938. And for the year of 1938, all three of them lived side by side in these two studio adjoining studio apartments. And then early in 1939, Rita left. I'm not quite sure why, but it may have had something to do with the end of an affair that she was having with a chap called Harvey Gresham. So the really core period of the Cambridge Terrace trio was 1938, and most of the important portraits of Leo by Rita and of Rita by Leo and of Lawrence by both Rita and Leo.
Yeah, they were busy painting each other. It must have been quite interesting in their digs.
There's a story about them sitting at opposite ends of the dining room table, drawing each other. This is Rita and Leo.
You have, I think, in the exhibition and the book, that remarkable Bensimon portrait of Rita Angus from just this period. I think it's
Which
glorious,
one are you thinking
actually.
Of?
Oh, this is the all on canvas that Te Papa has. Leo Bensimon,
yes.
Portrait of Rita.
Oh,
no, he did quite something. It's a very striking portrait where she's staring straight at us, and
yes,
she looks quite almost Elizabethan, actually, I think, to a certain degree.
I can tell you a story about that painting. It was always a mystery to me why, for example, he had painted her with black hair when her own hair was not black at all. And the eye colour is different as well. But then I discovered a letter put on to me by Jill Trevelyan, who was, of course, writing Rita's biography. And there's a letter, one of Rita's letters to Lilburn, in which she says, talking about Leo, and she says, oh, at one stage Leo and I played at being Antony and Cleopatra. And that suddenly, I suddenly realised that That painting is Rita as Cleopatra.
Oh, see, now you tell me, that's perfect.
Yes.
She's staring right at me.
And she's got a wig on, you know, and she could be, you know, either the historical Cleopatra or somebody dressed up as Shakespeare's Cleopatra, you know, as for theatrical performance.
The late 30s, clearly extremely important for Benjamin with the group. Talk me through the group and the significance of it.
Yes, well, he became a member in 1938. Everything happened for Leo in 1938. That was the year that he went to Cambridge Terrace. That was the year that he joined the group. And it was the year that he started working at the Caxton Press. So it was the crucial year for him. And I devote a whole chapter to that in my book. But the group had started about 10 years earlier, in the late 20s, 1927, I think. And they were a group of mostly women art students who decided that they would form a group and exhibit together. And not many of them are famous. The most famous of them now is Eve Page, or Evelyn Paulson, as she was then. And Nia Marsh was also part of that group. Anyway, the group started exhibiting in the Durham Street Art Gallery, and from about 1930-29, I think, they started putting out annual catalogues. And then every year or so, they would add a new member. And so Rita joined in 32 and Toss Woolliston in 36, etc. And members could propose other people as members. And so in 38, Rita proposed Leo for membership, and he became a member. And from then on, he was an absolute regular at group exhibitions. Almost every exhibition they ever held over the next 40 years, he had work in. But he became important to the group for another reason as well. From 1940, which I think was his second exhibition, because there were only a few exhibitions during the Second World War years. But in 1940, he designed the group catalogue, because by this time, of course, he was working at the Caxton Press and had access to printers. So, and once he had done it, he kept on doing it. And every catalogue from 1940 to 1977 was designed by him and printed by him at Caxton Press. So I regard that as a particularly significant connection, because it connects the literary world and the art world in Christchurch through him. He was the pivotal figure that connected those two worlds, and I think that's part of his historical importance, is that he was the pivot of a whole scene in Christchurch during a particularly vital period of its history.
It must have been extraordinary for him, because at the same time he's rubbing shoulders with those fabulous and passionate artists,
yes,
he's also, through his work at Caxton Press, getting to know some of the great literary minds as well.
Dennis Glover, Alan Curnow, Rex Fairbairn, R.A.K. Mason, Frank Sargeson, Ursula Bethel, the list just goes on and on.
Did he get to know them closely?
Well, he certainly got to know Glover closely, and Alan Curnow to some extent. I think he was actually closer to Alan's first wife, Betty, than he was to Alan. And I'm not so sure about the others. People that he did get very close to were Charles Brash a little later on, when he, of course, Brash was editing Landfall, and Leo was the designer of Landfall. And a little later again, Doris Lusk became a key figure. For the later Leo, Doris Lusk has a role somewhat similar to Rita Angus in the earlier period. One of my theories about him, I don't actually say this in the book, but it's something I believe, is that his work as an artist had two sort of take-off points. And in both cases, it was associated with a close relationship with a woman artist, Rita Angus around the period of 1937-38, and then Doris Lusk around, particularly around the early 1960s, when he suddenly changed direction and started painting landscapes, which he hadn't much done before that.
You describe Leo's place or role in New Zealand art history as ambiguous, and I'm interested in exploring that a little bit more. Mm.
The reason I say that is that at the period when he first started in the late 1930s and through the 40s, that's the what I call the heroic period of New Zealand nationalism. That is the period in which New Zealand artists were very conscious of putting New Zealand itself in the foreground and of consciously aiming for and achieving a kind of national style. And in a way, the group was the most important vehicle of that nationalist movement. And the people that were crucial to it were people like Olivia Spencer Barr, Toss Woolliston, Colin McCann, Doris Lusk, etc., all group members. Now, during that period when nationalism was being formed, and it was largely landscape, you know, Doris was painting central Otago, Rita was painting Canterbury and Otago, Colin McCann was painting Pangatotara, and Toss Woolliston was painting Ree Walker and the Mutiri Hills, etc. All of the group painters became identified with a particular area of the country, and of course the symbol of all that is Rita Angus's famous painting Cass, 1936. Now, while they were doing that, Leo was either making fantastic black and white drawings out of literature, out of Dr. Faustus, German folk stories, Japanese tales, Chinese dragons, things unimaginably remote from Johnsonville and Geraldine, to use Dennis Glover's phrase. And if he wasn't doing graphic work, drawings, wood engravings, book plates, caricatures, he was painting portraits, initially of entirely imaginary figures, like the St. Francis and St. Olaf, two of the really striking early imaginary portraits. But very soon he moved on to painting real people like Rita Angus, Lawrence Bagent, Douglas Lilburn, and so on. But what he wasn't doing was painting landscape. So the reason I say he is an ambiguous figure in relation to New Zealand art history is that he was completely exceptional at the period of nationalism. He was doing something quite different from everybody else. And yet, he was a key figure in the group that was creating that nationalist movement. And so that's why I describe his position as ambiguous. He was both inside it and outside it simultaneously. And then, to move on a bit, through the 1950s, his work became, well, it sort of fell off in quantity. I think he was very, very busy at the Caxton Press. He had a family, four children. His wife had four children they were bringing up. And he didn't do much painting in the 50s. He almost seemed to have stopped. And then suddenly, in around 1961, he started painting again, and he started painting landscapes. And the odd thing was that in the 1960s, after having ruled the roost for most of New Zealand art history, but and particularly since the 30s and 40s, landscape started to go out of fashion. Colin McCann turned away from landscape towards abstraction. People like Milan Mrkvicic and Gordon Walters were painting valuable abstractions. Quite a lot of painters started merging landscape and abstraction, people like Quentin McFarlane, for example. And so anyway, landscape was becoming unfashionable and other modes of painting were becoming central. And this is the very time that Leo took up landscape painting. So At every step, at every point in his career, he was out of step with his contemporaries.
Do you think that was part of his personality? You must have built up a picture through your research for the book and the exhibition, Peter, of Leo, the man.
Yes. Well, I do think it was part of his personality. It's worth remembering that when Leo came to Christchurch in 1931, he'd been a very undistinguished pupil at Nelson College. He couldn't have gone to university even if he had been able to afford to, and he couldn't afford to. His family were working class. His father was a blacksmith. But he came to Christchurch through his friendship with Lawrence Bagent. Lawrence came from a different social class, I suppose you could say. The Bagent family and Nelson were a well-established commercial family. They owned forests and timber mills and that sort of thing. And Lawrence was part of that family. And he and Leo became very good friends at school. And Lawrence's house, unlike Leo's, was full of books and art and music. Leo's house was notably impoverished, culturally speaking. But he sort of got adopted by Lawrence and his mother. Lawrence, she was a widow and Lawrence was her only child. And Leo, they sort of took Leo on. And when Lawrence came down to Christchurch as a student in 1931, his mother decided to move to Christchurch with him and set up a house for him in Christchurch. And Leo had left school. He couldn't get a job. It was in the middle of the Depression. And very generously and kindly, she said, well, why don't you come to Christchurch and live with us? And so that's what happened. Now, in Christchurch, Leo started moving with Lawrence's set, who were, of course, students, people like Ian Milner and Dennis Glover and Charles Spear and various others. But he was actually from a quite different background. He wasn't a young middle-class lad like those people. He was a working-class kid from Tarkiga, whose father was a blacksmith. And I think that he started assuming a kind of outsider role as a way of providing himself with an identity. And I think that all those masks and those weird figures that he drew in the early part of his career were part of an attempt to give himself a role in this world where he felt the odd man out. And so there was a slightly perverse aspect to his character. And I think that he perversely enjoyed swimming against the tide, and where everybody else was doing landscapes, he refused to do landscapes. And I think that that became part of his personality. And so that when landscape started going out of fashion in the 1960s, it's quite typical of that Leo would suddenly take it up, not giving a damn for fashion or whatever was the way you were supposed to paint, but going his own way in a kind of rugged independence.
Peter, if you were able to have one original work by Leo Benzerman on pride of place on your wall at home, which one would it be?
Well, I've got one.
Oh!
on my wall. And it's a painting called Tarkica Landscape. It's in fact, I own two Benzermans. I also own an early portrait of Lawrence Bagent that the family very kindly gave to me a few years ago. But the Tarkica landscape, it's worth mentioning that because it was really where my whole journey with Leo began. As I told you earlier, I did meet him in the 60s. And I became aware of him as a painter before I left New Zealand in 1968 and spent about a decade overseas. Then I came back to Christchurch in 1976 and I became aware of Leo again. And he held two one-person shows after he retired from the Caxton Press. One was in 1979 and one was in 1981. And in the 1981 show, I went along to it and I was just bowled over. I just thought the works were magnificent. And I remember quite distinctly I had this feeling, having this feeling that I was in the presence of masterpieces. These were paintings of old master quality. That was my belief, and I still maintain that belief. And what was more, I could actually afford to buy one. And I paid $600 for this Tarkica landscape. It took me months to pay it off. It doesn't seem a lot of money now, but it was quite a lot then. And proudly hung that painting on my wall. And I became so fascinated by it that I just developed this growing conviction that I had to write about it, make a study of this person and his art. And so I did. And I wrote a long article published in 1984 about his work. And he was still alive at that time, and I got to meet him and interview him. And that was where the whole thing started. And it's really, I've maintained this interest ever since. And I can't remember exactly when it was that I decided that I was going to write a book and organise an exhibition, but it was certainly at least 10 or 15 years ago that I developed that ambition, and now it's come to pass.
Leo Bensimon, A Fantastic Art Venture is the name of the exhibition on at Christchurch City Gallery, and Peter Simpson has called his book Fantastica, The World of Leo Bensimon. It's published by Auckland University Press.